Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good day, everyone. Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to another edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Shows which represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share your comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to our microphone for our first segment on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, Dr. Muriel Gillick, a physician specializing in the care of elderly patients and adults of all ages who are facing serious life-threatening illness. She's an author, a blogger, author recently of Old and Sick in America, and a blogger of Life in the End Zone. Dr. Gillick, welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. So much to cover in your work, in your bio, in all your writings, et cetera. In the book that I think was published at, in 2017, Old and Sick in America, you talk about the healthcare system, trying to navigate the contemporary American healthcare system. So let me just jump right in and ask you, based upon all your work, your research, your writings, your experience, what's the greatest challenge with our system today?
Well, there are different challenges for different groups of people. For older people, particularly those with lots of medical problems and who have difficulty in their daily lives, I think the challenge is that we have a system that provides extremely expensive care for them that quite honestly often doesn't meet their needs, doesn't solve their problems, doesn't improve their lives, and isn't even what they want.
Otherwise, it's just fine. Some of the work that we do when I go around with congregations and working with Jewish Sacred Aging, some of the conversation always comes back to what we call the economics of aging and navigating the cost factor. And as I'm sure you've had families in your office, and I know this comes up in workshops all the time, the just total frustration of once you're, quote, in the system, unquote, how to navigate the costs, the options, regardless of any of the ethical issues, just the mere fact of navigating this rather convoluted labyrinthine system. We don't do a very good job in this country of educating people, do we, about this?
We don't, and we also don't provide a lot of services in the sort of social domain, the piece of healthcare that is really the glue that holds the whole system together. That's family caregivers, social supports, community networks. The Europeans spend a lot more money than we do per person on those aspects of healthcare.
And with that, with the expenditures, you've been doing this for a few years, and you've written extensively on this, and you blog on this. Is a single payer system the answer to these healthcare costs, or just does the whole thing have to be redone and redrawn? And how really impossible is that to even consider?
Well, I think we need to realize that to some extent in older patients we have a single-payer system. We have Medicare. Now, there have been efforts to privatize it, and one could argue that the Medicare Advantage program, the prepaid health plans are a way of introducing many different systems and many different payers, but they all have to follow certain rules that are set by the mother of all payers, which is Medicare. So certainly for older people, and that's not, their problems aren't the only problems with our healthcare system by a long shot, but for that population, we kind of already have single payer, and that in itself is not sufficient.
And when you say it's not sufficient, what, you know, unpack that a little bit for me. It doesn't go far enough, or
Well, I think, as I said, suggested earlier, what we have is a system that doesn't provide high quality care at a reasonable cost, that often results in people having things done to them that they really wouldn't want to have done if they only understood what those things involved and if they were presented with alternatives. So in that sense, the system that we've developed for older people isn't working.
Well, you allude to this, what you write about, and I think one of your recent blogs, Life in the End Zone, also talks about something that seems to be now getting more attention in the literature, and that is futile care. So exactly how is that defined? What is futile care?
Well, that it's a real problem to define, and that's why most physicians and ethicists have given up on using that phrase, because futile care is supposed to refer to something that won't achieve its objectives, that can't possibly achieve its objectives. And it turns out that while there are certain things that fit that, you know, if you have cancer, extract of apricots is not going to solve your problem. There's no way it's going to solve your problem. So that would be a clear example of futile care. But often what physicians may regard as futile, patients or families may not, depending on what their objective is. So if you're in a persistent vegetative state, you're never going to wake up, but your heart's beating, you have some very minimal brain functions, then having artificial nutrition and hydration can be regarded as futile if the point of the treatment is to have you wake up and walk out of the hospital. It's not going to do that. But if the point of the treatment is to sustain you in that state indefinitely, then it's very successful. So futility has kind of fallen out of favor because it's such a tricky concept. On the other hand, there's certainly lots of treatments which have a very, 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 very low likelihood of doing even what it is that the patient or family is hoping that it will do, and where the burdens of that treatment are extremely high. And here I'm talking mainly about risks to the person, suffering that the person will go through in exchange for that treatment. There are also burdens in terms of cost, but futile care in that sense, what most people mean more colloquially, is care that is very, very unlikely to achieve anybody's goals and comes with a very high price tag, not just in terms of dollars, but in terms of human suffering.
That, you know, when we teach this as part of one of our programs, the idea that within Judaism there are actually boundaries beyond which you are permitted to change the nature of treatment and focus on a different set of values in many cases. Of course, a significant number of our people have never been taught this, which is a challenge. And when you try to do this at the last minute, sometimes it doesn't work as well. But there are. It's sort of like our tradition's approach to end of life and with treatment that may not be as beneficial, and you use that, you know, that risk benefit analysis as well. I'm sure you've had these conversations, as many colleagues, as many clergy have had, with family. Sometimes in the ICU unit or the hospital room, where that you'll basically say the arsenal has been exhausted, and members of the family says, we don't, you have to do everything you can to bring mom back or to allow her to function. How do you navigate that as a physician?
Yeah, well, I think sometimes, you know, it depends on the situation, obviously, but sometimes families say, mom always told us that she wanted everything. And, you know, we're supposed to do what the patient wanted, mm-hmm. if we can figure that out. And that puts families in this tremendous bind. But I try to unpack what she meant when she said, do everything for me. And I will suggest sometimes to families that what mom meant when she gave you this very potentially burdensome, fraught directive, do everything, what she meant was, do anything that has a reasonable prospect of restoring me to whatever condition she regarded as meaningful. That she didn't mean keep on doing things that aren't going to work just for the sake of doing something. Surely she didn't mean that. She just meant, as long as there's something that, you know, has a decent chance of working, whatever that means, but it's not an infinitesimally small chance, as long as there's something that has a reasonable prospect of working, then give it a shot. And then when it's put in that context, I can tell families, you know, what we're faced with here is we don't have anything that has a reasonable prospect of working. And so I think what your mom meant was, don't give up on her as long as there's still a good option. But when there aren't any good options, then don't invoke a bad option just for the sake of doing something.
Do you,
sometimes that works.
sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
When you sit down with families, let's say at the beginning of their journey, do you automatically walk them through the conversation about an advanced directive, healthcare proxy, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I like to get to that point. Often one has to talk about potentially sensitive issues after one has established trust, once there's a relationship. So ideally, that kind of conversation is in the context of a long-standing relationship. Often in the hospital setting, whether it's with the attending physician or it's with the interns and residents or it's with a palliative care consultant, the person in question is somebody unfamiliar to the patient or family. It's somebody brand new that they've never met before. So sometimes you have to work on some more concrete things like pain or nausea or their fever to earn their trust before you can go into those other sensitive areas. So, yes, I like to get there, but sometimes one can't just plunge right in.
We've had some conversations here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, and especially in some of the workshops we do, and I'm sure you've been involved in some conversations about this growing interest in legislation, on choice in dying legislation, which is now in several states and evidently in the pipeline in a couple dozen states. Do you have a position on whether, and I don't know where Massachusetts is on this, do you have a position on this? Is this a good thing for legislators to take up, and would you be in favor of that in Massachusetts?
Well, I've been extremely ambivalent. My focus is on figuring out how to make even tough parts of life as meaningful and as bearable as possible. And I think it's very, very seldom that the answer to the question, how can we make this bearable, is just by bringing it to an end. So I have reservations about that. It's certainly not the main focus of my work and where I think we need to go as a society.
In one of your, I think one of the writings, and we're talking with Dr. Muriel Gillick from Massachusetts, an author of several books on medical issues in the end of life, and a blogger who blogs his Life in the End Zone. By the way, let's do this too, Dr. Gillick. If somebody wants to touch base on your blog, how do they do that?
Well, there is a comment section, and there is a place where you can enroll to receive news of new postings.
And what's the web address? Is it lifeintheendzone.com, or how does one even access it?
Oh, dear. All right. So I ought to know this, shouldn't I? So it's one of these Dr. Muriel.
Oh, here. Yes. If anybody wants to touch base with the blog, go to Dr. Muriel Gillick. It's GILLICK.com. And I think that will give you access to the blog. That's Dr. Muriel Gillick.com. And Muriel is M-U-R-I-E-L. So in one of the books I think you did about denial of aging, somebody commented on the fact that you may have written the quote, "A good old age is within our grasp," unquote, and that this anti-aging, take another supplement, rub another cream, and you'll never age, is, quote, "a dangerous fantasy," unquote. Could you comment on that? What do you mean by the a good old age is within our grasp?
Well, I think there are lots of intractable problems in the world. You know, I don't know if peace in the Middle East is one of them, but it may well be. You know, there are just problems there are problems that seem to be incredibly difficult to solve. We know a lot about what kinds of things are important to people as they get older, things like community, things like being engaged with other people, being comfortable, having an environment that supports any disabilities that you might have. So we know a lot about what people want as they get older and how to help them achieve those things. But our focus on pretending that people aren't going to get old and that if only you pop this pill or use this cream, you'll stay young forever, may prevent us from doing the kinds of things that we ought to be doing, that we know work. And it's a waste of money, quite frankly. And it sometimes makes us think we don't need to invest in better institutions, better environments, better services, better treatments for people that could make things even better than what we already can achieve. Because why do we have to bother investing in a good environment for someone with dementia if dementia is going to be cured by popping a pill tomorrow?
So this dangerous fantasy is this belief that, you know, somehow we can just continue to push back the envelope. But science is working to push back the envelope, isn't it, though? The envelope of aging.
Yes, and whether that is a good idea and whether that's achievable is a whole other conversation.
No, it's very interesting. Yes, it is. I know, because I've spoken with some people who, Dr. Barzilai, I think, in New York, and some other books that I've read on this voluminous amount of research, evidently, that's beginning to develop on trying to extend the lifespan, you know, and as we sometimes talk about, the science can tell us how they can do that. The religious question and the ethical question may be why? You know, if you want to live to 110 in a rather frail condition of life, that as opposed to living to 110 and being like you were when you're 30, it's a big difference. The
right, and
one of the, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say one of the intriguing and challenging ways in which science is moving is to say that, yes, it would be foolish to just live longer and suffer more. What the goal is to postpone the aging process as a whole, so that instead of just saying, all right, we're going to cure heart disease so that everybody will have dementia instead, or we'll, you know, cure cancer and everybody will have heart disease instead,
right,
you're not
right.
making these sorts of trade-offs. You try to address the essence of the aging phenomenon itself and postpone that, not to create immortal people, but to prolong the period of healthy or vigorous life. So that is an interesting twist on this search for better living in old age and living longer.
One of the things that's come up here on the show a lot, and actually somebody who writes for the website has just writes exclusively on aspects of this, is isolation, Dr. Gillick. Increasing numbers of older adults who are isolated, who live alone or who are isolated in facilities. And how do we begin to, and all the health implications of isolation? Is it in your experience, in your work, in your writings, in your thinking, in your contacts with other people in the profession, how do we begin to meet this challenge? Because it seems to be a growing challenge.
Right. It's the problem of isolation is so complicated because it relates to the geographic mobility in our society, opportunities for women, so you don't have a natural caregiver for every older person. What can I say? It's the only good news is that it's not nearly as bad as in China, where their one-child policy really is causing a devastating situation. And you add to that their social policy of having millions of people move from the rural area to the city and leave the older people behind. So the only thing I have to say about social isolation in the United States is actually worse in some other places. But that said, I think there's a lot we need to do. I alluded earlier to the fact that other countries spend less per person on medical care and more on social care, so that can involve all kinds of programs that are supportive, community programs, whether it's a lunch in a senior center or whether it's friendly visitors or whether it's transportation to enable people who are shut in to actually mingle with other individuals. Those are initiatives that other countries have taken and that seem to be very helpful. The other thing I would say that's just a little bit of a contrarian perspective here, but to throw in the mix because you mentioned people being isolated in facilities, and that certainly can happen, but I just want to make a little plug for situations in which staying home, which is the current rage, aging in place, staying
right.
in the community, in your house, in your home of the last 40 years or whatever it is, that's not always such a great thing. Being in that house can be extremely isolating, and whereas being in a good congregate living environment, whether it's a nursing home or an assisted living or something else, can be from a social perspective and then secondarily from a health perspective a much better solution.
Yeah, the socialization, I know that there's this growing tension about, and I think boomers are really looking at this I've talked to people in our generation who basically was saying, well, if that ever comes to me, I'd rather go into a house with a bunch of friends of mine and be together as opposed to being in, you know, Shady Acres nursing home. But I think you're absolutely, I mean, we know that, that the future is going to be very, very interesting about how people handle this challenge of living, aging in place by themselves, living in a group home or living in a facility. And I'm sure that costs, I'm not sure, I know, and as you've alluded to, the costs and the economics of that will play a huge role in that. Before we start running out of time in this segment, I do want to ask you to comment. In one of your recent blogs, I think at the end of January, you mentioned this rather interesting advanced directive, actually downloaded and used it at a recent workshop by Dr. Gaster, the University of Washington, specifically geared for individuals getting the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And I know you've written about that. And talk to me a little bit about why you think this is such an important step in caregiving and caring for individuals and families working with Alzheimer's disease.
Well, I guess the context is that I think while it's important to talk about death and dying and planning for the very end, that there's a much bigger problem and a much longer period of time that we don't pay nearly enough attention to. And that is the years that often come before death is imminent, when someone may have a variety of debilitating illnesses, one of which might be Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia. People who are physically frail, who have many different problems typically, although sometimes it can be one very severe problem which affects many different functions, people in that state are pretty fragile, and the approach to life, what's important to them, what kind of medical care they want, are all things that we don't pay enough attention to. So I see dementia as just a specific case of that more general problem. And the reason for thinking about advanced directives with dementia is that if you have physical frailty, you can think about what's important to you, what really matters after you've reached the stage of physical frailty. You don't have to be imagining what it might be like before it's something that's happened to you. But in the case of dementia, if you don't think about it in advance, you are not going to be able to participate in the conversation about what approach to care makes sense for you. So that's why I think that addressing, thinking in advance about what you would want if you have dementia, not just in its very last gasps, but given the long trajectory of that illness earlier in the course of the disease, is extremely important.
Can one find meaning in those stages of Alzheimer's and dementia? Can one find meaning?
Well, it's certainly challenging. I think that there's a lot of good evidence that in the early stages of dementia, people find lots of meaning. I think that as dementia progresses, there are still ways that people seem to relate to other people, respond to their environment, that seems to bring pleasure and joy to them. So whether it's listening to music and seeing someone who is quite profoundly demented tapping her foot or clapping her hand, I think those are ways that people still derive meaning from life. Music, I should mention parenthetically, is very, very powerful in many people who have lost lots of cognitive function.
The challenges of what you're talking about, actually, it's a great segue, and I want to thank you for it, because our next guest, Alan Yaffe, is really pioneering a worship service using hands and clapping and music, specifically geared for individuals dealing with Alzheimer's. So that's why I wanted to poke you about this and get some of your opinion. It's really interesting segue that, and we didn't rehearse this, what we're ending with is what we're going to begin with in many ways in the next segment as well. So we've been talking with Dr. Muriel Gillick from Boston, a physician specializing in the care of elderly patients and adults of all ages, an author most recently of Old and Sick in America, a blogger of Life in the End Zone. And you can access that by going to, if you're ready, http://blog.drmurielgillick.com. That'll give you access to this very, very interesting, exciting, and very, very profound blog, Life in the End Zone. Dr. Gillick, thank you very, very much for being a guest with us here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Continued good luck, continued success in all that you do, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Shalom and welcome back to our second segment here in today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. And we are pleased to welcome Alan Yaffe, who hopefully is on the line. Alan, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Rabbi.
Hey, how you doing? How are you? You're also up in Massachusetts, right?
In Worcester, Massachusetts.
Wow. So it's a big Massachusetts day, and I won't mention the Super Bowl. No need
Thank
to.
You.
Thank you very much. So it's interesting. So Dr. Gillick, our first segment guest, and when we ended on this conversation about Alzheimer's and finding meaning, and she said, you know, people who respond to music and physical movements such as clapping, and we want to talk a little bit about two things today. Not only your new Sharing the Journey Haggadah, published by the CCAR Press, which we'll do. But because Dr. Gillick alluded to this at the end of her segment, I want to talk to you about SPARK, which is what? Tell me about SPARK. This is very exciting.
Well, SPARK is a Jewish Sabbath service designed for healthcare center dementia residences and assisted living memory residences, and for families with a loved one diagnosed with memory loss or dementia, when the person is living at home with the assistance of a caregiver. That's the overview.
What's the difference between what you do with SPARK and walking into the congregation in Worcester and sitting down Friday night for a regular Friday night service? Walk me through the difference. Why is this service different from all other services, to paraphrase?
The service is, first of all, it's a short service. It's a roughly half an hour, 40 minutes. It is designed for persons who, again, have memory loss or dementia, and their families and their caregivers. My father had Alzheimer's, and for the last 4 years of his life, I was his, you know, case manager.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, he lived at home with a caregiver and my mother. He lived at the Eisenberg Assisted Living Residence in Worcester in their memory impairment unit, and he also lived in the Jewish Healthcare Center, a skilled nursing facility, on the Alzheimer's floor. After he died, and this is a little bit of the history, Rabbi Matthew Berger, who was the rabbi at Temple Emmanuel at the time, where I was a member, asked if I would volunteer to conduct a service once a month at the Jewish Healthcare Center, and it turned out to be in the on the Alzheimer's floor. And I have been doing that now for 9 years. And the service was, again, that we were conducting during this time, was short, using familiar liturgy. We focused on bringing the residents into the moment with personal interaction, with, again, the familiar liturgy from the CCAR, Mishkan Tefillah, and the music. But a little short time ago, I went to the board of the healthcare center and asked for volunteers to assist in conducting these services. And one member said that they hadn't realized, one member of the board said they hadn't realized that the services were being conducted, and that if she had, she would have been there with her mother when she was there. And in fact, when we conducted these services, it is very rare that a family member is present. And it just occurred to me that we could do more. That the families and the people with their loved ones, the people with memory impairment or dementia, were sharing a journey that could last many years. It was very emotional and a very difficult time. And I believe that in the spiritual context of a Shabbat service, that was a good place to strengthen the connection between these people sharing the journey. It was a good time to give thanks to each other and to renew hope. And by hope, I mean that, you're not going to recover from Alzheimer's based upon the current state of medical knowledge. But there still needs to be hope on this journey that you will have the strength to appreciate every day and the spirit to live each day fully. And that with love and giving thanks and commitment, which can be done at the Shabbat service, we could help make this possible. And that was really how this originated, and this is what I'm trying to do in the service.
I think one of the most powerful parts of this the liturgy is this section in the service that you've entitled, you had just alluded to it, A Shared Journey. And there's significant emphasis on caregivers. And you have a prayer for caregivers, and you subtitle it Those Who Care for Us. It's really something that, you know, I from the life of me, I don't understand why every single congregation doesn't do this on a regular basis. Because as I go around, every time I ask this question on a congregation, how many of you are caregivers in a workshop or on a Friday night service, invariably 40 to 80% of the people raise their hands, you know, have been or are caregivers. Some of the liturgy here is, you know, you write about, or you have, if I'm not mistaken, ask the caregivers who are present in the room to really read together, correct? Some of these prayers you ask them to do together?
Absolutely. We want to interact and be as welcoming as possible and bring everybody into the moment for the short time that we have. So there is the prayer for caregivers that may be led by the service leader or family members standing in place of those who aren't able to fully express themselves. And then there is the caregiver's prayer, a prayer that those who are in their care may have the strength to fully grasp the gifts which they continue to have and enjoy the fullness of each day. These are the relationships which we hope to strengthen by this service.
Right. You alluded to some of this. There's this wonderful line here. Help from Shabbat to Shabbat. Help each of us to share our sacred journey with those in our care and those we love, so together we may go from strength to strength. And you also include this, and I want you to just talk to us a little bit about this. There's a section here in the shared journey section, which says the service leader may ask the children participating in the Shabbat service to read a poem that they've written, or say a few words to their loved ones, or read in unison a prayer that you print in the context of the liturgy. You know, for some people say, wow, you know, here's that grandchild coming to to be part of this service with grandmom or grandpop who may be dealing with Alzheimer's, and the children get a chance to read something in appreciation, in love. You know, you actually write, the share a smile, touch of hands, share a hug. I'm interested. Why did you? I think it's great, by the way. I can't understand why more people don't do this in a liturgical sense. But what was the genesis, the motivation of including this section in the Share the Journey section, the kids?
I think it's important for the children, and it's also important for the person with dementia or memory impairment. When my father had has Alzheimer's, I made sure my children, they were older at the time, but when they came home, always went in and spent some time with him. It is an unfortunate, it's a part of life. What is the saying that there is some bitterness is a companion to life's sweetness? And this is a part of that that time. But from that, you need to find ways to create hope. And I believe children of most ages should be able to relate. And it's important for the again the person for with Alzheimer's. And by this little poem that I wrote, sharing a smile, a touching of the hands, a hug. It's that interaction. And ultimately, it's a saying to the children, saying to the person with memory impairment or Alzheimer's, we should remember with love all our time together, which is my last line in this. It's a little poem. And I believe that is extraordinarily important for both parties.
I'm sure you've been asked by this by people who you may have spoken to about a spark. Well, the person dealing, you do this, let's say, in a nursing home, do the people who are there, do they really understand, do they really grasp what's going on? And you've had this experience. You're doing this, you said, for several years. What's been your experience?
9 years.
I'm sure 9 years. So you've probably run the gamut from people with just beginning this journey towards the end of the journey. What's been your reaction to the doing of this service?
Well, I can tell you that the healthcare center is very excited about the fact that we have been doing it and doing it for 9 years. So that's been very positive from an organizational level. You know, it's interesting. Your last guest referred to music,
mm-hmm.
and music is very powerful. Let me tell you a story about music. We have music throughout the service. And always, many times in the service, there is a person there, and I'm talking now the dementia unit at the skilled nursing facility, who has, from the very beginning, has their head down. It's as if they are asleep. And then we get to the very end, and I do a concluding song, and the concluding song is Ain Kelohenu. And it's five verses, as you know, and the music is about the same. And we start to sing Ain Kelohenu. And all of a sudden, this person who has had their head down and you think they're asleep and maybe just there and not understanding anything lifts their head up and starts mouthing the words.
Right.
I mean, they're not really saying the words. They're not really singing it. But they are mouthing Ain Kelohenu through all five verses. And I can't tell you that were they asleep the whole time and this just came up, or were they really listening and this was something familiar, more familiar that brought them even a little more conscious forward. I don't know, but I think it was positive for them. And I've seen the same thing. And by the way, someone else who does the service, I do it once a month, uses Adon Olam at the end, and they've gotten the same reaction. We've also gotten that reaction on the Shema, when we do the Shema.
Right.
So, yes, I think that for many people, by creating a warm and inclusive and interactive a service with familiar liturgy and music and the clapping that you referred to before, I think many people do benefit from it, and do relate to it.
Have you had experience with the bread, the blessing over the hamotzi, the blessing over the challah, with people touching it, and also reacting the same way because of this tactile sense of and the smell and the holding and the feeling of the bread? Have you had experience with that, with the same type of positive reaction?
Not really. I have not seen that. However, and again, an interesting story. When we do the motzi, which is at the, you know, the very end, I always ask everyone there, do they want to do the blessing humbly or joyfully?
Mm-hmm.
And then ask someone, somebody makes a choice. And over these 9 years, there have been times when humbly has been selected. Once someone even said, let's do both, which we did. But overwhelmingly, this is the end of a half hour, 35-minute service. Different people each time, they all say joyfully.
Right.
They wanted the service to be joyfully said. And I think that that speaks to the power of what a service can do. And, you know, you're trying to create a little bit of hope that they will be able to have the spirit to live each day fully and the strength to appreciate every day. And hopefully this this service plays a part in that, not only with the person with by including not only the person with all, with dementia or memory loss, but also family members, and giving thanks to caregivers who are also present.
So what is your ultimate goal of this service? Are you going to try and mass produce it and make it available to other memory care units?
I am. I guess the next step is to approach a publisher. I don't know if the CCCIR, I think, has a full plate right now. I'm not sure the timing is necessarily right, but perhaps them or someone else. I will add, if there is someone out there who is as committed as I am and perhaps had a family member who had dementia and would like to see this done and would like to donate a large amount of money to dedicate the volume, that would be great to do because it's not a question of just publishing. I want to do artwork. It'll be an oversized,
right.
I envision it as an oversized volume with larger print and very powerful illustrations.
You're speaking with Alan Yaffe, attorney and activist, and I think I can use that phrase advisedly, activist in the Alzheimer's memory loss community. And the development of Spark, it's very, very interesting, fascinating, and many wonderful Kabbalat Shabbat service for use of individuals dealing with Alzheimer's, their families, and caregivers. But I also want to take some time, because you mentioned the CCAR Press, Alan, to congratulate you on the publication of Sharing the Journey, the Haggadah for the Contemporary Family, just published by the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the CCAR Press. This is a beautiful new Haggadah with, you mentioned illustrations, some very, very beautiful illustrations throughout the Haggadah. So I have to ask you, what was your journey on creating this? Why did you do this?
Well, when my son graduated from college, I have four children, and when my son graduated a few years after that, he introduced us to a lovely young woman who happened to be Christian. And I realized at that point in time that I really knew nothing about interfaith relations, an interfaith dating of my children, and perhaps that was something that I needed to learn. So I did some research and was fortunate to find in Boston there was what was then called the Outreach Training Institute. I think it's now called URJ Outreach Boston.
They
conducted not only classes on basic Judaism for interfaith couples and anyone else who wanted to take it, but also a couple of times a year had seminars on this interfaith relations for Jewish professionals and for lay leaders. So I began attending those seminars. And after a period of time, I spoke with Dr. Paula Brody, who was the executive director of the Outreach Training Institute and perhaps the reform movement's most or foremost authority on interfaith relations, and asked her if there was a Haggadah that she would recommend that addressed the contemporary family. The contemporary family, which I was defining as a family that had persons who were born Jewish, with perhaps a variety degree of knowledge, persons who had the same family, had persons who had gone through a conversion class and chosen to be Jewish, and the same family who had one member or more who was a person of another faith. And Dr. Brody at the time told me there was not one that she could recommend, so I said, well, I'm going to write one. And that was the beginning of what turned out to be a 3-year journey.
Well, you write in the beginning, sharing the journey encourages us to be sensitive to the unique personal and religious background of each that each individual brings to the retelling of the Exodus story. Certainly, the subtitle of this Haggadah, the Haggadah for the Contemporary Family, given the radical changes in what makes up the contemporary American Jewish family. So this speaks not only to the interfaith couple, but I would imagine that those people who will be a month from now, just about a month from now, sitting around the Seder table from a variety of different backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, religious persuasion, sexual preferences. How does this Haggadah encompass all of that amazing diversity, which is now part of who we are?
With difficulty to do all of that, but I think I have, with the assistance of the CCAR. I guess the best, maybe one way to explain it is the best compliment I think that I ever received for the Haggadah was from a rabbi who said she loved the Haggadah because for persons of other faiths or cultural beliefs, and for Jews who have less experience with Jewish rituals and traditions, it was understandable. And as a rabbi, for her, it was meaningful. Meaningful, I have always taken to mean that it helped her find meaning, understanding in the traditional text. So that's what we tried to do. And we also try to address, again, a larger group of people. It's very careful. We have gender-sensitive language. When we refer, for example, to the on matzah, the three pieces of matzah, a reminder of God's covenant with the patriarchs, which also here it's patriarchs and matriarchs, in telling the story of Moses and the liberation of Egypt, there is a reference to the midwives, Shifra and Puah, who didn't distinguish between sons and daughters after Pharaoh declared the death of the firstborn. And there's also a reference to the bravery of Zipporah, Moses' wife, on the journey to Egypt when Moses was going that way. So we tried to be very sensitive that way. When we reference to the Holocaust, we've included a portion of the Holocaust, and that includes not only the 6 million Jews who perished, but also refers to the others who were killed because of their ethnic origins, sexual orientation, disabilities, or political beliefs. I think I don't know that we've addressed every audience, but we've attempted to do our best.
No, but you also, and people should know this, there's opportunities, there's like these little green blocks in various parts of the Haggadah that invites conversation, invites people to stop, take a look at themselves and share, a short discussion. Based upon the themes of that particular section of the Haggadah, how does this?
And I should add with that. I mean, you know, I think there are 4 or 5 of those places to do that. That we encourage questions. I mean, the rabbis teach that every generation is obligated to make the story of the Exodus their own. So throughout, we put these series of questions on the central theme of freedom. So anyone, regardless of faith, may be able to participate. And I should add, because of constraints of time at a Seder, I would not recommend that every one of those 4 or 5 periods for discussion be undertaken. You would definitely go till midnight.
You're not a big fan of the five-hour Seder, right?
Yeah. Choose one, or for that matter, choose one of your own, a question of
right.
your own. We're supposed to be asking questions. The Haggadah encourages it, provides some examples. People who create their own seders at home may want to purchase a copy of Sharing the Journey for ideas that will help them. That's what we're trying to do. And we also, I should add to that, at the end of the Seder, there's also an opportunity for everyone to share a blessing or a memory that the Seder and the leader invites those who wish to participate to share a blessing they've received, share something they've learned during the Seder, or simply a Passover memory that they have or a Passover memory that's been created during the Seder. So again, inclusive, participatory for everyone present.
Right. That section is right before the fourth cup and the Shana Haba'a B'Yerushalayim section. And there's songs in the back. And interestingly enough, you've included Take Me Out to the Seder, which is very timely this year since the first Seder is the opening week of the baseball season. So you're very prescient and prophetic in doing that. Sharing the Journey is published by the CCAR Press. Alan, how does one get a hold of this? Somebody wants to buy it. How do they do that?
Well, it's sold at the CCAR Press. The best way is to go online. It's sharing.ccarpress.org. It will take you right to the section. And I need to add here that this is a good time if you are interested, because the CCAR is allowing me and is providing a 40% discount to everyone listening to this podcast, or who will listen to the podcast. So if you go to sharing.ccarpress.org and purchase a copy and the promo box add Passover 40, Passover in caps, you'll get a 40% discount. The Haggadah normally retails for $18, so it's $10.80. And we hope to, the idea here is, again, all proceeds of this go to the CCAR, which is nonprofit. I do not get anything from this. My sole intent is to get this to the audience who can use it and benefit it most and help people have a more joyous Seder.
Can you get this on Amazon as well? Since a lot
you
of
can
people...
get it on Amazon, but you cannot get the discount on Amazon.
So that's very important. It's worth the time. CCAR Press. And again, because we only have about 2 minutes left, give us the whatever it's called. Since I'm computer challenged, if I want to go through the CCAR Press,
sharing.ccarpress.org. And that will take you directly to the page for Sharing the Journey. And again, in the promo, where it says promo code, enter Passover 40 for the discount.
Alan, what is your hope for not only this Haggadah, but walking as we are in this last couple of weeks before it's Purim, now walking into Passover, your Haggadah, your work with the service? Is there some underlying hope that you have for you and your family, combining all these very, very important spiritual moments?
It's a big question. For the Seder, I hope that we'll be able to have people using it. The Haggadah will have a more joyful experience. We'll have an inspirational one, perhaps be inspired to learn more, to study more. We'll find themselves, the Passover Seder, a source of a discovery of spiritual foundation of Judaism, connecting them with their families. And as we go through, say, the four children for the wise one, hopefully it will renew and strengthen commitment to the pursuit of freedom, justice, and tolerance. And if it can do even a little portion of that, I'll be very grateful.
Alan Yaffe, thank you very, very much for joining us. Congratulations not only on Spark, the service, the Alzheimer's family caregiver service, but also Sharing the Journey, the Haggadah for the Contemporary Family, available through CCAR Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And continued good luck, and say hello to the rest of your family for me, please. All of you, thank you for being part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows will be archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our website, JewishSacredAging.com. And again, we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or the Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging Radio on Facebook. And these shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And thanks to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you. Shalom. Take care.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.